From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. The United States marking 50 years now since President John F. Kennedy was killed in Dallas, Texas. The city, which has long struggled with the legacy of the assassination, hosted a series of official events on Friday, as did many places around the country. President Kennedy, who served less than 3 years, is often ranked among the nation's most favored presidents. Just 46 when he died, he is praised for his youthful vigor, his leadership through the Cuban Missile Crisis, and his vision to put a man on the moon. And tonight on Coast to Coast, four special guests, each one with their own thoughts and theories behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Charlie Manson may be getting married. Maybe. That's what one of his biggest fans claims. This is what she says. I'll tell you straight up. Charlie and I are going to get married. She's known as Star, according to Rolling Stone. She says she takes this very seriously. Charlie is my husband, and that's the way it is. The notorious, well, self-described, whatever he may have been, had a group of people kill under his command. Manson is 79 years old. Spends hours every weekend with this 25-year-old woman in a prison in California, obviously serving a life sentence. Well, you might soon be allowed to make cell phone calls while flying, but be prepared to pay a little extra for it. Keeping customers connected to mobile networks in flight would be a major opportunity for U.S. carriers, potentially worth $2.4 billion a year, according to an analyst. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, an expert on these things. I'm not sure I'd want to be on a plane, Lauren, with everybody talking to somebody else.
Yeah, and in fact, this has turned into really quite a controversy when the new FCC chairman Wheeler announced yesterday that the FCC was considering rulemaking in this area. There was such an outpouring, like 95% negative, people calling the FCC, calling news programs, calling stations, everything, saying they don't want people jabbering in the seat next to them through long airplane flights, that Wheeler came out today with another statement, said, now, look, personally, I don't really want anyone talking to me neither. It's just a rulemaking meeting. Don't get so excited. The thing is, it's a sociological question. It's not a technology question. By putting the microcells in the planes, having those microcells connect directly to special ground stations or to satellites, you're not transmitting to the normal cells. You're not going to interfere with the normal cell network. They're not going to let you use the phones if this kind of thing passes below 10,000 feet anyway. So you can do it technically, but sociologically, I don't know. There's a couple of foreign airlines that already do this. I suspect that in the long run, it's going to happen here too, but there's going to have to be some real negotiation between people when you have a real idiot next to you jabbering away for a long flight.
And you're trying to sleep. And I've got to tell you, Lauren, I have enjoyed my downtime without having to have a smarter cell phone on. You shut it off, and if it's a 2 or 3 or 4 hour flight, it's got a little peace of mind. You don't have to worry about your phone.
Yeah, and in fact, if you listen even to the people that you would think at first glance would be the most pro being able to talk on their phones on airplanes, they say exactly what you just said. They say, you know, they appreciate the downtime. Sometimes the only chance they have to get away from their phones and from the callers and from all the things they have to do is on those plane flights. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see how this thrashes out.
Lauren, if we don't talk to you before Thanksgiving, have a great one, my friend. Okay.
Same to you, George, and to your audience. You're always great.
Well, you have supplied us with wonderful information over the years. Citing two deaths by cord strangulation, the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission has said that the Angel Care company is recalling 600,000 Angel Care movement and sound monitors with sensor pads. Now, if you have one of these, just you got to be careful. The cord attached to the baby's monitor sensor pad is placed under the crib mattress, which poses a strangulation risk if the child pulls the cord into the crib and becomes wrapped around its neck. Be very careful. It's a voluntary recall. In one case, a 13-year-old girl died in San Diego, 13-month-old girl died in San Diego in November 2011, In another case, an 8-month-old girl died in Oregon. Very sad stories there. Well, here's a story that I'm not sure you would fall for, but scientists have created cheese using skin bacteria from the human feet and armpits. I kid you not. I would never, ever eat that cheese. Let's check in. What a transition. Now we go to Peter Davenport from the UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what
well,
a story.
I'm with you on that, George. I like cheese, but not that much.
No way. There's no way. What's going on in the world of UFOs, Peter?
Well, I'm really pleased to be on, as I'm always pleased to be on this program. It's always an honor to be here. I thought I was going to start off my presentation tonight with a few of the many dramatic reports that came out of New England, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, all but Rhode Island and Connecticut. For some reason, those two states were not included. But I took about 2 to 3 dozen reports in very rapid sequence, George, from places like Montpelier, Vermont, Randolph Center, Vermont, Bristol, New Hampshire, Norwich, Vermont, Bridgewater, Mass. And people can see a very nice photo that one of the witnesses caught there with a digital camera. In all cases, George, the witnesses are reporting clusters of red or orange objects, the same ones that I've been talking about on this program for now a year or year and a half. And it's very unsettling to me what's going on. I apologize to my audience for being so monomaniacal on these fireballs, but nobody can figure out what they are, and they're showing up everywhere. Even tonight, they showed up in Palm Bay, Florida, out on the east coast of Florida, just south of Melbourne, Florida, and which in turn is just south of Cape Canaveral. Gentleman was driving south. He's a professional driver, had his GPS unit on, looked out ahead to his quartering right. He saw a cluster of orange lights streak from his right to left. Not too many hours later, a woman was standing in Port Richey, Florida, over on the west coast of Florida, and she was watching an aircraft at relatively low altitude fly from her right to left. It was headed north, and she was flabbergasted to see what she thought was a flying wing or a triangle behind and just below that aircraft. Suddenly, the triangle banked to the west, that is, to its left, and at that point, she could see that it had orange lights on it, and it suddenly streaked out of her sight to the west over the ocean. I don't know what's going on, and there are many other reports from tonight. Durham, North Carolina. This morning at 1 a.m., Redmond, Oregon, a gentleman who works as a professional in aviation, driving to work, and he saw an orange light hovering over his neighbor's house. Suddenly, the object streaked off in the night sky at very, very fast speed. He drove half a block or more and saw another one hovering over a different house. He asserts in his report that the second light appeared to drop something onto the roof of the second house, and that one, too, went streaking off. I could go on and on and on.
Sounds like an alien agenda, that it's just like Jim Mars's book, that there's something going on here.
Yeah.
All right, Peter.
I agree with you, and I've read Jim's book. And I always appreciate what he has to say about the UFO phenomenon. He's very well schooled in it, I feel. But this is the first time in 19 years that I've become alarmed by the nature and volume, both, of the reports that are coming in here. But I will keep the coast-to-coast audience apprised of what's going on. The best way for them to assimilate this material is just go to our website, UFOcenter.com, and start reading some of the reports, most of all the reports from New England just two nights ago, the 20th of November. Very, very dramatic night.
And as far as you know, Peter, no one has been hurt from these orange bursts of lights, right?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't believe I have a report suggesting injury or any kind of danger from them. Most recently, I've had a couple reports that they've landed. These are relatively new phenomena, new developments in this phenomenon, I should say. It appears, and this is pure surmise on my part, George, a qualitative assessment of what's going on. It appears that these objects are becoming more brazen, and they're showing themselves more clearly, closer to people. Tonight, the sighting in Durham that I alluded to earlier, the gentleman estimates that they were within 200 feet of one of these objects. It was on the ground. They estimated its size is roughly the size of a car. It lifted off the ground and wound its way through some standing trees. It suddenly turned, and when it turned, they were looking at a different side of it. What they saw was no longer a bright red light, but rather a white light. Very interesting sighting. And when our webmaster gets back from helping an ill parent out in Cleveland, we'll have all of these reports posted to our website.
Great. Thank you very much, Peter. We'll talk to you next week as well.
Thank you, George.
You're very welcome. And, of course, just talking to Jim Mars, we will be bringing him back in just a second. He wrote the book Alien Agenda. But tonight we talk with Jim about Crossfire. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie, our first guest during our JFK special, Jim Mars, noted author, researcher, his latest book, Crossfire, of course, which he wrote some time ago, but he has been updating it. He is an award-winning journalist, more than 30-plus years experience with several major Texas newspapers. And here he is on this pretty momentous day. Jim, thanks for joining us tonight. Appreciate it.
Hey, George. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I find it hard to believe that it's been 50 years since the Kennedy assassination. Of course, I have an explanation for my problem, which is I taught a course on the Kennedy assassination for 30 years, and that means every fall, every spring, I watched the newsreels all over again, watched the interviews with the witnesses all over again, looked at the documents again, and for me, it seems like, oh, yeah, Kennedy assassination. Well, that happened just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it is too fast, 50 years. Some people I've heard, Jim, some young people who weren't even born then, don't understand the significance of this story. And I want you to take a few moments to tell them, those who are listening, who were born after 1963, just what this means.
Okay. Well, to me, it's real simple. If we do not have a truthful understanding of what happened to the 35th president of the United States, then how in the world are we supposed to be able to figure out what's happening to us today? I think it's that simple. Now, for your audience, some people are real interested in the Kennedy assassination, and some are just kind of, well, you know, if you got something new to say, let me hear it. And some just really don't much care at all. But let me just cut through all of this. We could spend several programs on the Kennedy assassination, and over the years, I'm sure you have yourself talked to various guests, and you hear this, you hear that, claim, counterclaim, charge, countercharge. People get so engrossed in it that pretty soon they're talking about, well, what did Oswald have for breakfast, and how many shots were fired, and from what location, and let me try to cut through all of that. Let me just get down to the basics here, okay? The Kennedy assassination today is just a matter of faith and trust, okay? If you have unlimited faith and trust in the federal government of the United States, then you will believe the evidence that they have presented, and I'll be the first one to admit that it's pretty incriminating against Lee Harvey Oswald as the lone assassin. However, if you have any doubts as to the veracity of official pronouncements, and let's not forget light at the end of the tunnel in Vietnam, weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, you know, the air quality is perfectly fine on Manhattan after 9/11. If you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan, right? So there's good reason not to believe everything they say. And in this case, there's every reason not to believe it. So once you understand that, then you question the evidence as presented by the government, and you'll find that it begins to fall apart. Here's what I'm talking about.
Sorry.
First off, on the Monday night following the Friday assassination, the Henry Wade, the district attorney of Dallas, held a press conference, and towards the end of it, almost offhandedly said, oh, have I mentioned we've got his fingerprints on the rifle? Well, that pretty well took care of it for most people. Fingerprints on the rifle, obviously he did it. But let's look closer at this. On the Friday night of the assassination, the rifle and all of the evidence in the case was taken away from the Dallas police quite illegally by the FBI with no jurisdiction, based on on pressure from Washington, mainly from aides of his successor, Lyndon Johnson. And the rifle was sent to Washington, to the FBI crime lab. The next day, in a document signed by J. Edgar Hoover himself, it said no usable prints were found on the rifle or even the inner parts of the rifle. Then on Sunday morning, Oswald's killed by Jack Ruby, and on Sunday evening, the rifle is shipped back to Dallas. On Monday morning, two FBI agents, Harrison and Vincent Drain, carried the rifle over to Miller Funeral Home. The newspapers even made a notation that the FBI team spent a long time in the morgue, and the funeral home director, Paul Grudy, who I became very good friends with, told me back then and now that he was there when they put Oswald's dead hand on the rifle. In fact, he said he had a tough time getting the black fingerprint ink off of Oswald's dead hand in time for burial that afternoon. And that afternoon, that evening, they said, we've got his fingerprints on the rifle.
And you've got to believe him, Jim. He's not lying.
No way.
There is no way he'd be lying. You can't make up a story like that.
Okay. Number two, the Gerald Custer was the naval technician at Bethesda Naval Hospital who took the x-rays of Kennedy's body prior to the autopsy. Floyd Reby was the naval technician who took photographs of the autopsy. Both of these men are now on the public record stating that the photographs and x-rays shown to us now in the National Archives are phonies, fakes, and not the x-rays and photographs that they took. Of course, this news doesn't ever get told to anybody. Knight Ridder published the story, and I know I found the article in the Seattle Times, but no, I couldn't find it in any other paper. This is distortion of the evidence, suppression of the evidence. In fact, in this case, there's a whole list of criminal activities: fabrication of evidence, destruction of evidence, alteration of evidence, suppression of evidence, and intimidation of witnesses. That I can cite at least two dozen people whose claim that the testimony they gave to the Warren Commission was altered and changed. The Edna and Wayne Hartman told the FBI that they saw a bullet plow into the make a furrow in the grass across Elm Street, and they said it lined up with the grassy knoll. But in their FBI report, it said that they saw a bullet mark in the grass, and it lined up with the Texas School Book Depository. And when I contacted both the Hartmans, they said, no, that's not what we told them. Major Phil Willis, a World War II hero, was taking photographs in Dealey Plaza that day. And when I asked him about his treatment at the hands of the federal government, at the hands of the Warren Commission, he laughed and he said, well, I'd tell them yes, and they'd put down no. You cannot trust the evidence. This is why, George, that there is so much controversy in the case of the death of John F. Kennedy, because there is such a gulf between the government pronouncements, which a lot of people have just accepted at face value, and people who have actually studied the case and find out that it's not at all what they said.
Jim, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back more with Jim Mars as we talk about the JFK assassination. We have three other guests that'll be joining us throughout the night as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment. We'll be back in a moment more with Jim Mars and his work, Crossfire, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Jim Mars with us. Jim, back in 76 to 78, the U.S. House Select Committee on Assassins investigated the death of Martin Luther King Jr. and John F. Kennedy. And with Kennedy, they concluded that it was highly likely he was assassinated as a result of a conspiracy. Now, at that time, I was at WJBK Television in Detroit. It was not a major story. I don't recall it. And to this day, it's really not looked at as a big story, yet here we have the House Select Committee on Assassins concluding that it was probably a conspiracy, even though they say that Lee Harvey Oswald was involved, there was another gunman probably at the grassy knoll, and then they threw out and said the Soviets weren't involved, the Cubans weren't involved, the CIA wasn't involved, the FBI wasn't involved. I don't think they did a very thorough job there.
No, they didn't. And the problem there was is that they got sandbagged by federal agencies just like the Warren Commission. They started off and they looked at the evidence that's presented by the FBI, and the FBI, of course, had all of the evidence quite illegally with no chain of command, no chain of evidence from that Friday night until Tuesday morning, when it became the official evidence. Nobody looking over their shoulder, nobody seeing what they took in or put out or whatever. And as a result, right up towards the end, the House Select Committee was all prepared to say that it was Oswald with three shots from the school book depository. But Blakey, their senior counsel, head of the assassination committee, had said early on that they were not going to look at any new evidence, but they would review old evidence. And suddenly, at the last minute, they came up with the police dictabelt that was a recording of the radio communication with the Dallas police. And on there, was recorded the shots. And so they had a acoustical scientist study that, look for impulses. They went down to Dallas, set up microphones all along the street there. I know because I was there covering it as a newsman. And they recorded firing shots from the school book depository and from the grassy knoll, and they matched up. So they said, well, wait, there was a gunman on the knoll. Well, they didn't really want to hear that. So they hired another set of acoustical scientists, and they did the same thing, and they came up with the same conclusion. So at the very end, they're out of time, out of money. They suddenly had to say, well, there was probably a conspiracy because we have scientific proof plus other evidence indicating that at least one shot came from the knoll. But, oh, we're out of time, we're out of money, so it was still three shots from Lee Harvey Oswald and whoever it was behind the fence. We don't know who it was, but he probably missed. Okay, it was a terribly inadequate investigation. All they did then was turn over all of their findings to the Justice Department with the admonition that that Justice Department continue the investigation and find out what really happened. And that did not occur. The Justice Department, all they did was handpick some experts who called the acoustical studies into question. They said, oh, well, they weren't using the right methodology and they didn't get it right. And then that hit the news. And then about 2 years later, a peer-reviewed scientific study in England came back and said, no, the scientific committee, the National Science Foundation that had called into question the study, their methodology was wrong, and that the two acoustical scientists were correct. There was a shot from the knoll. So here we are, constant controversy, constant confusion, which is the cover-up in the Kennedy assassination. Usually we think of a cover-up as a lack of evidence, but in this case, it's obfuscation. It's too much evidence. Too much arguments between experts, claim and counterclaim, charge and countercharge, until the average guy starts scratching his head and says, ah, man, I don't know. I don't know if I even want to know about anymore.
Exactly. Exactly. Did you ever look into the possible connection between Vietnam's Madam Nguyen and Lyndon Johnson? Was there any kind of a tie-in there with the assassination?
Well, the whole thing, I think the key straw that broke the camel's back was indeed Vietnam. And of course, there was a lot of money flowing there, a lot of drugs coming out of the Golden Triangle, a lot of defense contracts, particularly for Texas. I know I was here living, working in North Texas at the time during Vietnam and served in the Army during Vietnam. And I want to tell you, Texas did pretty good. We were selling helicopters from Bell Helicopter. We were selling instruments from Texas Instruments. We were building planes and stuff at General Dynamics, Ling Timco Vault. They all had huge defense contracts. contracts, and everybody was doing pretty good, okay? So they really wanted that war. And what we now know is that on October the 11th, 1963, Kennedy authorized the issuance of a National Security Action Memorandum 263 that basically said he agreed with the plans to pull out of Vietnam and have everybody out by the end of 1965. And in this document, it says, make no formal announcement, but begin the withdrawal of 1,000 military advisors. On the Monday following his Friday assassination, Johnson issued a National Security Action Memorandum 273, which blocked and stopped that pullout order, and in fact ordered them to draw up plans not only against North Vietnam, but against Laos. Talked about the plausibility of denial, and it set us on the course for Vietnam. And of course, it was not until the August of 1964 and the phony Gulf of Tonkin attack, which never occurred, that he got the Gulf of Tonkin resolution pushed through Congress, which allowed him to wage war, and he immediately began to send ground combat troops to Vietnam. So in other words, if Kennedy had lived, in my mind, there was no way that we would have had the Vietnam War as we had it.
And the Federal Reserve would have been changed, I bet, right?
Absolutely. That's another thing. That's another big factor, I think, that another straw that broke the camel's back was in June of 1963, Kennedy authorized the issuance of $4.2 billion in United States notes. This is currency issued through the Treasury backed by silver that the government had on hand. Now, the $5 red ink United States notes were not worth any more than a Federal Reserve note, but we didn't have to pay interest on it. Okay, officially we owe $16 trillion right now, and to pay off the national debt, which is the interest we have to pay on the money that we borrow through that collection of banks known as the Federal Reserve System. Now, here's what's interesting, George. That by doing this, Kennedy became the second president in U.S. history to issue interest-free money. The first was Abraham Lincoln, who issued greenbacks to finance the war between the states. And I'm here to tell you, I, for one, do not think it was just a coincidence that both of those presidents who issued interest-free money were shot in the head in public.
Well, that's a good point, too. I mean, and I think the two groups who didn't want Kennedy killed would have been the Soviets and Castro. Because, the Soviets, Khrushchev was getting along with Kennedy, negotiating the Cuban Missile Crisis down. And I think Kennedy, some say he botched the invasion of Cuba. I don't think he wanted to really go through with it. That was a plan by Eisenhower and Nixon, wasn't it?
Exactly. In fact, Kennedy was not even aware that there was going to be the Bay of Pigs invasion until after he had been elected in November of 1960. And then the invasion, of course, was in April of 1961, just a few months later, and it took a month to build up for that thing. So in other words, he was faced as the new president with a fait accompli. They said this is already planned, it'd been authorized by the previous administration, and you mentioned Richard Nixon. He was the one who, in his book, My Three Crises, took full credit for planning the Bay of Pigs invasion. But interestingly enough, and to show the difference between presidents, we now have a president which, no matter what happens, he blames it on somebody else. But after the failure of the Bay of Pigs invasion, when Kennedy could have gone on television and said, well, folks, this wasn't even my idea. I didn't even know about this until I got elected and they told me it was already planned and I had to go through with it. He got on television. I can still clearly remember it. He said, look, this happened on my watch, and I'll take full responsibility for it. But the truth of it is,
and his popularity went up, Jim. His popularity zoomed after that.
That's right.
As a matter of fact,
people understood that even if it had been a big mistake, at least he owned up to it, and he was straightforward and honest about it. And we haven't had one like that since, except possibly Jimmy Carter, and he didn't last very long.
So what did?
By the way, let me throw this in. This is going to be a wrinkle that you may not have ever heard about, and this sounds crazy, but this is absolute truth. Speaking of Jimmy Carter, In mid-1979, they were getting ready to go into the election year of 1980, and everybody was already griping about Carter, saying that he was wishy-washy on the fence. He couldn't seem to make up any make a decision, and that everybody was touting Ronald Reagan for president.
Well, okay? And we had the Arab oil embargo. We had the Iranian hostage situation.
Exactly.
All that stuff was
happening. All that stuff going on. So in May... Carter had asked for national TV time, and the pundits were saying that he was going to start announcing dramatic new changes in the government and in policy. But before that happened, he went to Los Angeles for a Cinco de Mayo celebration, and while he was there, they arrested an Anglo who took him and led them to a hotel room where they found empty rifle cases and empty boxes of ammunition. He also pointed out a Hispanic fellow and said he was part of it. And he said they told the authorities that they were basically street people, and they'd been picked up by these Mexican assassins who had come up out of Mexico, and that they were to create a diversion. The Anglo had a starter pistol on him and 74 rounds of blank ammunition. They were supposed to create a diversion, and these hitmen out of Mexico were going to kill Jimmy Carter. Okay? Now get this. The Anglo was Raymond Lee Harvey, and the Hispanic was Oswaldo Ortiz.
Oh, come on.
Lee Harvey and Oswaldo were involved in an assassination plot on Jimmy Carter. He canceled his national TV time, did not make any changes in the government, and was handily defeated in November by Ronald Reagan.
I've got to ask you about the quote from Oswald when he was being let out of the police department initially, and he said, "I'm a patsy."
Yeah, he said, "I didn't shoot anybody, I'm just a patsy." Now, you would think, since the chief suspect said that, and it was recorded on sound and film, that the government investigations, mainly the Warren Commission and the House Select Committee on Assassinations, that they would have at least stopped and thought, well, you know, could he be telling the truth? Let's look. Is there any evidence to show that perhaps he was set up? Perhaps some of this evidence, which is so damning to him, you know, could have been contrived and just created. For instance, some things just didn't make sense. At that time, there were no gun control laws. If Oswald wanted to go and use a rifle to shoot the president, all he had to do was go to downtown Dallas, go into any pawn shop. He could have bought a rifle, paid cash, walked out. There would have been no paper trail. But instead, we're told he ordered a rifle through the mail, sent to a post office box that, you know, could be tracked directly to him.
And you can't put a rifle in a P.O. box, which means he'd have to go and sign for it at the counter.
Right. And yet they never quite came up with the signature, okay? They're not real sure who got in that box because the records had been destroyed.
James,
the whole thing stinks to high heaven, and this is because here's the thing. Here's what it comes down to. John J. McCloy, a very powerful banker and one of the more prominent members of the Warren Commission, who had been the High Commissioner of Germany at the end of the war and had allowed lots of Nazis to come over to this country under Operation Paperclip, and his protege, Alan Dulles, who had become the longest-serving director of the CIA, and both of them sat on the Warren Commission. And John J. McCloy made the comment early on in the transcripts of the Warren Commission meetings. He said, it was of paramount importance that we show the world that America is not a banana republic where the government can be changed through conspiracy. So that's what they were trying to do. They weren't trying to investigate. They weren't trying to find the truth. They were trying to prove the world that we weren't just a banana republic. But I'm here to tell you and your listeners, and I'm sorry, I hate to be the bearer of sad tidings, but we are just another banana republic. And there was a coup in 1963, and this country's been on the skids ever since.
Has anybody with all our technology run that Oswald, I'm a patsy voice through some kind of special lie detector that you can pick up by voice?
Yes. Yes. That recording, which is still available, has been subjected to voice stress analysis, where they can register the amount of stress in a voice. And if you're lying, your voice gets very stressful. And if you're not, it's not. And it shows that Oswald was telling the truth.
See, that's a major story. That's
of course
huge.
It is, but you don't read that in the newspapers. All you read is this psycho babble about, well, there's just crazy conspiracy theorists, and they just can't accept the fact that the lone nut can kill the great man, and I guess we just need to bind up the wounds, and we just need to move on, and let's forget about it, folks. You know, You get that instead of these factual matters that show that there was something else going on.
I remember Mark Lane, who was a great investigator into the Kennedy assassination. I think he was on the late Mike Douglas's show years ago, and he was showing a picture of what looked like Jack Ruby on the day of the assassination standing outside of the school book depository building. Do you remember that picture?
Yes, I do. And
there
were several people, including Gene Hill, including Phil Willis, including some other people who said that they saw Ruby in front of the depository at the time of the shooting. Phil Willis, who was a major in the Army and a decorated war hero from World War II, told me that he knew it was Ruby because he knew Ruby. He had met Ruby. He knew who Ruby was, and he saw him and took a picture of him. And he said, but when the Warren Commission published his picture, they cropped it off right through the middle of the fellow who was Jack Ruby. Now, the official version says Jack Ruby went to the Dallas Morning News, was seen there about noontime, and was seen there about 1 o'clock, and therefore he was at the Dallas Morning News. But what they don't tell you is the Dallas Morning News is only a short block and a half or two blocks from Dealey Plaza. And he could have gone to the Dallas News, been there up until 12:15, 12:20, tootly-bopped down to Dealey Plaza, been around there for 5 or 10 minutes, gone back to the Morning News, and been seen again there by 1 o'clock.
I'm going to very quickly throw out some titles of groups that could have killed Kennedy, and just give me a very brief yes or no, okay?
Okay.
The mob.
The mob. The mob could have killed him, but they certainly couldn't have misdirected a federal investigation.
The CIA.
CIA, they could have killed him, but they too would have had a problem pushing it all this past the Pentagon and the police agencies and the Secret Service and on like that. Plus, there is evidence to show that Oswald was being used operationally by the CIA prior to the assassination.
The military-industrial complex, which could leak into this.
Now we're really getting to it, because Oswald can be connected to that. There was plenty of people upset with Kennedy, and they certainly had the means, motives, and opportunity to take out Kennedy. But the key thing here is, how about all of those? Because under Operation
All of them
Mongoose,
together. And then I was going to throw out Hoffa too. He hated him.
Yeah. Well, so we got. Well, see, that's what's kept the researchers kind of off balance for years. Is once they push aside the fact that it was Castro or it was some foreign government, then they've been arguing all this time, was it the CIA, the FBI, the anti-Castro Cubans, or the mob, or the military? And the thing is, the answer, I think, is yes, because all of these elements were participating in Operation Mongoose, which was the secret war against Castro, under the leadership of General Edward Lansdale, who was very proficient in overthrowing governments and in assassinating foreign leaders. This is all historic facts.
Bingo, Jim. Bingo. Jim's book, of course, Crossfire. Up next, we'll be talking with Dr. Walt Brown, JFK Master Chronology, and some other issues that he has written. And we will be interactive from here on. At the half, we'll take your questions. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.